Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today, I'm delighted to be talking with Alex Christie, author of the historical novel Gutenberg's Apprentice, published by HarperCollins last year. Alex is a journalist and a printer, and Gutenberg's Apprentice is her first novel, about which she is speaking to us from her home in London. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Thomas. Thank you so much for calling.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on the show. And you're a Vassar graduate?
I am indeed. In fact, it's wonderful to be able to imagine you sitting on campus. I graduated in 1980, which seems like a very long time ago, and studied philosophy at Vassar. Yeah.
So you were a philosophy major. Who did you study with?
I studied with Mitchell Miller. He was my thesis advisor. And actually, interestingly enough, my thesis was on why certain philosophical ideas need to be presented in a literary form. So even then, I think I was thinking about writing literature and fiction. And, you know, even though philosophy is a fantastic training for moral questions and the moral imagination, I've always been really interested in both ideas and in the creative expression of those ideas. So, I think one of the things that was wonderful about Vassar for me is that it encourages you to go really deeply into whatever your subject might be. And I think that's probably something that, as a journalist and definitely as a historical fiction writer, has been useful. You know, this idea that you need to learn as much as you can before you start flapping your jaws about things.
Yeah. So what inspired you to write a novel, and how did you decide to write it about the story of the first printed book?
It's a complicated answer, so I'll try and kind of break it into pieces. I'm a journalist. I've been a newspaper journalist for 30-odd years, and yet at the very, very early beginning of my life, I wrote both a newspaper for my family and wrote novels at about the age of 10. So I think I always had both these strains in me. And what happened was I went back to graduate school and got a master's in creative writing after my children were born because I really wanted to pursue fiction. And at the same time, in the history of my family, there is printing. My grandfather was the foreman of a type foundry in San Francisco, which exists to this day, which was and remains the most important hot metal type foundry in the U.S. And he taught me how to print. I was his apprentice when I was 16. So I had this love and interest in letterpress always. But I really never imagined that I would write historical fiction at all. And the reason that I wrote this book is it purely came out of a piece of research that I read about in the New York Times that was conducted at Princeton in the early 2000s about what exactly Gutenberg had invented. There was research into how the types were actually made.
I remember that. It caused quite a stir in the history of the book circles and history printing circles, I remember.
And it hasn't been settled. I just thought it was curious and interesting, the idea that maybe the types made that were used for the Bible were not as advanced as we had thought. And so what happened, though, is I went to another fabulous institution, the Strand Bookstore in New York, and I stumbled upon a monograph about this person, Peter Schuffer, who is now the hero of my novel. And even though I knew quite a bit about the history of the book and printing, I had never heard of him. And it turned out that he was this incredibly important figure. In fact, really the first great printer. He printed 300 books. No one really knew how to situate him, although it was clear that he had something to do with the first printed books. So, you know, bit by bit, you begin to dig into a story. And I would say this is my journalistic side. I began to realize this was this amazing story that not only was tremendously important historically, but, you know, it ended very badly, and it's a great drama, and no one had ever told it, you know, so I got more and more interested the more I learned.
So a story sort of arises out of your curiosity.
Exactly. My original interest, and in a way it goes back to that arcane expertise that I talked about earlier, was I just really wanted to try to puzzle out as much as I could how they might have done it. So in a way, it became a little bit like a mosaic of putting it together and trying to figure out if the theory that had been advanced, that these types were not made in the way we long thought that they had been made in a mold, in a metal mold, then how could they have done it? And I just really, it was a question of me imagining what the steps of the technological invention might have been. And for a long time, that's really all I focused on was the history of the book and the history of the technology. And then gradually I wrote many drafts, and I began to realize that, of course, you have to situate it in the world of the time. And it became a whole other endeavor.
Interesting. So the questions here are questions about process, and I can see why narrative would be the natural form you'd want to use to look for answers, so that historical fiction might work as a better investigative instrument, more so, say, than a scholarly article.
Well, that's really very much the issue, I would say, of the day, you know, and when you talk about the popularity now of very serious historical fiction. Since Hilary Mantel started publishing with Wolf Hall, there's been this growing discussion about the role of historical fiction. And History Today, which is a publication in Great Britain, you know, said, well, finally, the historical novel is finally respectable, i.e. serious, you know?
Yeah, there is, it seems to me with historical novels, there's a tension between imagination and memory, if not a trade-off. I mean, I'm sure that they work together. Do you have that sense when you're writing? I mean, there are historical novels, say, like Walter Scott's, that are mostly imagination. There's not a lot of research put into his work, and they're wonderful novels. I mean, Ivanhoe was one of my favorite books when I was a child, but it's a different kind of genre almost than the kind of work that you and Hilary Mantel do.
Well, I think what I realized when I immersed myself in all of the literature about Gutenberg, which, as you can imagine, is voluminous in several languages, what I began to grasp, and maybe it's because it's a long time ago, more than 500 years ago, much of the documentary evidence has been destroyed, and there are huge, huge gaps in our knowledge. So when we talk about memory and what we actually know, it's precious little.
Yes.
And so almost all of the various theories that have been advanced for the last 561 years have been interpretations. And I think that historians know that they're advancing interpretation based on more or less, you know, justifiable evidence.
Yes.
And I guess to me, it's really a question of intent and sort of integrity of the author, you know. We all fall in love with our own version of the narrative and can begin to believe that it's the only true version of the narrative. I think for me, I wanted to just try to find a story that fit the facts as we knew them. And the primary facts in the Gutenberg story are the books.
Well, in some way, isn't all history writing a species of fiction? Not to use the word pejoratively, but narrative always has to be in part a creative endeavor, doesn't it? And history is never just a relation of the facts as they happened in the past. For one thing, it depends upon perspective, doesn't it?
Exactly. And I think, you know, one danger, of course, is that the general reader takes it as gospel. You know, that's always, I think, a danger with popular things, with movies made about events. You know, and again, it comes back, for me, I really tried incredibly hard to be as factual as I could.
Mm-hmm.
But inevitably, there are invented pieces. The most important invention of all is trying to deduce what kind of people these were.
Yeah.
And give them, you know, characters. And that you can only do based on what little you might actually know about them.
Yeah, sure. As a librarian, I always wonder about the research that goes into prose narratives of any kind, you know, especially narratives like the novel. And the thing that strikes me about the historical novel is just how much research must have to be distilled into just the mere quintessence of text. Since in constructing even a semblance of a distant reality, whether you're talking about people or just events, you have to know so much about everything. And it seemed to me, you know, I noticed this when you described the group in the workshop, they're taking Christmas dinner. You really have to know what they eat. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have all kinds of passages about what the landscape must have looked like, what it must have smelled like.
Yep.
So this is a very research-intense sort of enterprise, isn't it?
It is. And I think what I never intended to write historical fiction, really. You know, I was grabbed by this story. And most of the things that I have written up until now have been contemporary, in fact. And I think what I've realized is that you have to some extent, be obsessed, and you have to be really allow your inner nerd to go full rein, to give full rein to that, and absolutely embed and sink into it. And, you know, the internet is a fabulous thing because you can learn so much from your desk about what people ate and what people looked like. And as an art historian and in the art department, you could probably appreciate that my major source for everything about this period was visual.
Yeah.
From paintings and from illumination and from tapestries, because that's where you see the daily life of the people.
Yes.
But, you know, wonderfully enough, the Gutenberg Museum in Mainz, there are so many people trawling over this territory that you have books on what Gutenberg ate. You have books on, you name it, there's a book about it. So I did do an enormous amount of research in the political sphere, which we can maybe talk about later. But it was very complex and very difficult to comprehend how the world worked
Yeah,
then.
That was one of the surprises and most interesting things you had to communicate was the fact Gutenberg and company didn't do this work and come up with this invention in a political vacuum by any means. There was a lot going on, an awful lot going on politically and historically at the time that really must have impinged on everything they were doing at every moment almost. Mm. So you focus on here not just an historical event, but one of the events in Western history. You know, the invention of the printed book is something of a sort of quintessential historical moment. So that made me think while I was reading the book right off the bat that I was actually reading a book not just about an invention, but I was reading a book actually about history. So the book serves not only as historical fiction, but it seems to be a kind of meta-history. And interestingly, the device you use to frame the story is of the recording of history from memory. You know, so you have here a kind of history within a history.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And as a librarian, I'm sure that you will appreciate this, that in the 15th century, they wrote chronicles and it was believed and it was possible to tell the whole history of the world in one volume, you know. So that was a time absolutely hard for us to imagine now, you know, so different from our own, this explosion of history. But the thing that I found really fascinating in researching this period, which I really knew nothing about before, although I'm married to a German and I knew a bit about German history, is just the parallels in terms of the civilizational shift that those people lived through at the end of, this was the end of the Middle Ages. And, you know, the invention of printing, as we now know, has been called by most historians the most important invention since the wheel, you know, and it radically transformed society in ways that I think a lot of us now think we are living through a very similar hinge period in history, possibly the end of individualism, the rise of the hive mind, who knows, you know, but something very big is going on now. So one of the reasons my editor at Harper loved the book, aside from loving the story and the characters, is she just felt that there were these tremendous resonances with today. And I didn't set out to do that. I really set out to try and figure out how they made the metal type. It was that simple. But as I wrote it, and especially, you know, as the different events occurred in the civilizational conflicts between Islam and Catholicism, these various things, I really felt very much a sense of deja vu. And yet at the same time, as you say, it's about what people remember about things. And so I was very, very keen to keep this frame narrative, which Peter Schuffer, who is the narrator of the story, is telling the story of the invention to the abbot Trithemius 35 years later. And this actually occurred. He actually did speak to Trithemius, and we know because Trithemius made a chronicle of this event, and he wrote it actually in two different chronicles. Unfortunately for scholars, he didn't write very much. You know, he wrote about four sentences about this earth-shaking thing. But I felt two things were important to me about that. I wanted Peter to be able to look back with a significant remove of 35 years on the invention and sort of evaluate the technology and the impact.
Yeah, it's an interesting device, I have to say, because it's about the recording of history from memory.
Well, and don't you also think, I mean, I just think as a human being that we all construct the story of our own lives. And for me, the interesting thing, imagining these three men in this relationship, Gutenberg and his venture capitalist, I call him his financier, and then Peter, who had a father-son relationship with both of them, it must have been devastating when the whole thing blew up. And I felt that having this type of frame narrative, it allows Peter to, in the telling of his story, to try to come to a new understanding of what happened in the past.
Yeah, really brilliant device. So this is, interestingly, I think, a story not so much about Gutenberg, the genius inventor, but it's about collaboration, which makes it very contemporary also in terms of a narrative about invention.
I mean, this is the thing that I found so astounding when I found this book at the Strand. And I think this is the reason that I'm very reticent about standard received narratives of history, because if you Google Gutenberg or if you look anything about Gutenberg, you know, it's always about Johann Gutenberg. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, the incunabulists, the people who study this period, they know very well that Johann Fust was deeply involved and they know that Peter Schuffer was deeply involved. And I was astounded to learn this. You know, it was sort of, to me, it was like, who were these other two people and why have they been in Gutenberg's shadow for half a millennium? And I had a wonderful talk with the former deputy keeper of the British Library, who's an expert in incunabula. And she said, you know, all of our historical narratives conform to the era in which we make them. And so the interest in the Gutenberg story grew up during the Romantic period. And so we cling to this very romantic notion of the lone genius from the 19th century onward. And as you said, we now understand that almost all innovation comes through teamwork. Of course, there's an inventor, but then there are people who execute the ideas and there are people who finance the ideas. And, you know, the Gutenberg Bible was 1,286 pages and it took 2+ years to make. And, you know, the man did not do it by himself.
No, and not all at once either. Of course, as soon as you think a moment, this is not just the invention of an idea. It's the invention of a whole process of doing something entirely differently than it's been done before. So obviously there has to be a lot of trial and error and something that takes place over time.
And very iterative, you know, and this is why just in the last 6 months, really, right about the time that my novel came out, another book came out by Walter Isaacson, which was very interesting to me because he wrote the biography of Steve Jobs, who, to a large degree, I think I modeled some of Gutenberg's character on Steve Jobs. And I actually use a statement from Isaacson's book in the frontispiece to my book. He then went on and wrote a book called The Innovators, and it's all about how you can look at the entire history of the computer age and Silicon Valley, not as a story of these great men, but as a story of teams, and that most innovation is teamwork. And I think it is. It's, again, we may be falling in the same fallacy of viewing the past through the prism of our age, but it never seemed to me realistic or logical that this thing would have sprung full-blown like Athena from the head of Zeus, from this one man's head. As you said, there was the press, there was the ink, there was the type. There were so many pieces that had to work together.
So you don't take Gutenberg as your protagonist, you take Peter Schoeffer. Did this seem to you then the best channel to get into the process of printing? Why was it Peter Schoeffer and not Gutenberg?
I think first and foremost, it was because no one has ever heard his story before. No one, I would venture to say, outside a very small group of people, no one has probably ever heard of him before, you know, in the broader public.
Yeah, the first I'd heard his name was on a show here when Elizabeth Eisenstein brought him up.
Well, he wasn't this extraordinary figure. He actually became the first major printer. And, you know, he, right after the Bible, he and Fust brought out the Mainz Psalter, which everyone agrees is the most beautiful book ever printed. It's a three-color masterpiece. And then he went on and printed 300 books, and he co-founded the Frankfurt Book Fair, and he became fabulously wealthy and had a dynasty of four generations of printers. So he was this incredibly important figure. So I just thought, wow.
She mentioned him in the same way you use him here, also in that he was a figure that sort of straddled the world of manuscripts, and that he was a manuscript artist, a calligrapher. So there was that culture, and then there was what she calls print culture, and they were very, very different. And she says you see that in him, actually.
And that's really, I would say, the core of the story. And as I began to live through his eyes and think through his mind and try to write him as a character, I began to realize just the ambivalence that he must have felt. Because, you know, the work of the scribe was holy. It was the transmission of God's word. It had a tremendous depth of meaning. And the industrial age of print, when you read the book, you discover he has to go through this process of rejection before he can come to see what printing is. And I, for me, as I wrote it more and more, I began to realize that he was the perfect character to tell the story, because he expresses all the ambivalence that I feel about the digital age as a person who is steeped in print, and that the wonder, but at the same time, the uncertainty and the fear, because we don't know what it's doing to our brains. We don't know where it's taking us. You know, the beauty of the age of manuscripts, we traded that beauty and that very narrow dissemination among a very limited group of literate, wealthy people for a whole different kind of media. And he was a very spiritual guy. And I think the other really important thing to think about is just how different the world they lived in was from ours, and the way they interpret everything was religious. And we know he was religious because of the kinds of books he printed afterward, all canon law and that sort of thing.
Yes, and of course he's a young man. He's much younger in the book than Gutenberg or Fust. So the narrative then serves in some ways a kind of Bildungsroman, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah. You know, he was a full generation younger, and he was 25. And, you know, if we think back to when we were 25, this is the most exciting time of your life in many respects.
Yes.
And also, that's why I thought he was such a wonderful character, because what an experience to be able to be involved in this extraordinary thing with this extraordinary man at this time, and then to be an older man and look back at it and realize those were the best years. That was the most extraordinary thing he had ever done, and it was never to be repeated. And I just thought, that's an exciting time of life, you know.
So the other major character is Johann Fuste, and could you give us an idea of who he was?
Yeah, it's a very interesting person. Johann Fuste was a merchant. He came from a family of goldsmiths. His father was a goldsmith and a judge, and his brother was a goldsmith, and they continued in that vein for quite a long time afterward into the 16th century. So they were a very well-to-do family in Mainz, and in those days, anybody who was a long-haul merchant who was selling cloth, and they sold books as well. So we know for a fact, it's been documented, there was all the documents surrounding the lawsuit exist, that he financed the workshop. And the thing that's very interesting, and I don't want to, it was always a tricky thing to tell the story because you don't want to give away too much, but at the same time, everyone knows that the Gutenberg Bible was printed. Yeah. So, and I felt it was important to say from the beginning, this is not a book about if it happened. It's a book about how it happened. Mm-hmm. And it did end badly. It ended up with the partners locked in a very bitter lawsuit. And what has happened over history is that Fuste has been absolutely demonized by the historians, by research, as the person who destroyed the partnership and stole Gutenberg's invention. And really, the facts of the matter are much, much different. And there's much more recent research that has rehabilitated Fuste, first of all, as an artist, because it turned out he actually did hire a painter to illuminate a whole bunch of copies of the Bible. And he seemed to be someone who really knew a lot about marketing and selling books on the one hand. And on the other hand, it seems that the money that he gave Gutenberg probably wasn't enough, and Gutenberg probably took money from other people, and the whole finances of the operation were somewhat botched. Yes. And so it was, put it this way, it was never black and white. Who was at fault?
Fuste eventually becomes identified with Dr. Faustus, exactly. Doesn't he? I mean, he has a very bad rap in the end. So,
well, it's very murky in history, and it's really the fault of Peter Schoeffer's son, because his son Johann became a printer. I have a feeling his father would have been turning in his grave, but his son basically claimed the invention for Fuste and Schoeffer and tried to write Gutenberg out of the history entirely. And so it wasn't until, I think, 17-something or other, that there was this publication, The Restoration of the Honor of Johann Gutenberg, in which everyone said, oh, no, he was the real inventor, and these other guys were absolute crooks and creeps who tried to steal his glory. And so that really tipped the scale against Schoeffer and Fuste, and has until this day, really. So my goal was just to say, you know, it's never that simple, and we know that these three men, Gutenberg couldn't have done it without them. They were obviously deeply, deeply involved in the thing. They continued as printers, and let's look at it afresh.
Yeah. And this was really an adventurous undertaking, and they really thought big, didn't they? I mean, a Bible, especially a Bible of this size printed in this many copies, is quite something. I mean, considering all the resources that did have to be gathered and put into it, and how many people it actually took over how long a period.
Well, this is where I really had to do a lot of historical sleuthing and intuiting of how it might have come about, because nobody has ever known why they chose the Bible. There's no documentary evidence at all. Aside from the lawsuit and the books themselves. And there was this bizarre gap in time where no one knew what they had been trying to do. And I was very fortunate in my research, and I found a PhD thesis about the monastery, the Benedictine Monastery of St. Jacob's, and the project that they had had to print a missal, which is a mass book. And it all seemed to come together because the types that they designed initially weren't really appropriate for a Bible. So this is where the whole political aspect of the story became really important to me, is trying to understand, well, why did they do that? Mm-hmm. Initially, they didn't have such a large press run. They had a smaller press run. But why would they pick a book like this? It's really not necessarily a bestseller. It's definitely not something that most people can afford. It's for a very specific market. So it was more a question of working backward, trying to figure out why they might have done it. And again, it's my interpretation. I was fortunate I got to address the Printing History Association here in London in the fall. And I do feel, you know, digging up some of these other historical pieces of research helps to round out the picture, because book historians tend to focus on the book history. And I found a wonderful new analysis of the lawsuit by a legal historian. And I found this whole huge history of PhD thesis on the how Dietrich von Erbach, the Archbishop of Mainz, how his court worked and how it functioned. So just by piecing together some of the other external factors. Yes.
Yeah, that's extremely interesting here, in that because your enterprise is synthetic and it's syncretic, much more so than what you would get from most historians. Even cultural and social historians aren't quite as wide-ranging in their research as you have to be here, and that must then allow you to put disparate kinds of things together to form hypotheses that a straight-up historian might not come up with.
Yeah, it brings me back to Vassar and my Hegel seminar with Miller, you know, because I think journalists are by nature synthesists, and that's the job that we do, is we take as much, we cast our net as wide as possible and try to gather as many facts and then sift and try to see what's plausible and what's not plausible. And so, you know, from a procedural standpoint, but as you said earlier, you know, then the challenge is not to let the book drown under the weight of all of this stuff and actually tell a story. That's harder. I liken it to a spiral. You write a while and then you realize what you need to know more and you go research and then you come back and you spiral ever deeper into, you know, figuring out where the story is and what the drama is.
Yeah. I got the impression that apart from your reading, you put a lot of your experience of having been a printer and a printer's apprentice into the book.
I did. I was, as I said, when I was 16, I apprenticed to my grandfather, and he was from the very wonderful old school of industrial printers. It was a trade, it was a job. It wasn't an art form. It was how books were printed and newspapers were printed. It was the heyday of hot type in the 20th century. And he was a very humble, patient, wonderful guy. And to some extent, Hans Dunne is a little bit like him in the book. Mm-hmm. And I also apprenticed to a fine press publisher in California who was much more of an artist, demanding, would scream and yell and throw things on the floor. And if you didn't do it right, you went and did it again. Mm-hmm. So this perfectionism in printing, because it's a mechanical craft, you know, it has to be right. There's no wiggle room. It's either it's good or it's not good. And there's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of hard, boring sweat and tears that goes into it. And, you know, I really think that the physical aspect of making stuff is something that's so important. It was part of my agenda in the book, I guess, to rehabilitate or remind people how important it is to use your hands to make things.
Yes, and when I think of printing, when most people think of printing, fine printing, letterpress printing, you don't tend to think of typecasting as being part of it, but that's a big, of course, part of what this is. And you do have an unusual experience in that with your grandfather's business.
It's true, no. And I mean, even by the time I got interested in it, there had long since been, you know, steam printing and industrial production and the monotype caster, which casts individual pieces but uses a keyboard, a kind of a proto-computer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had been to the foundry, I had seen how it was made, but I had never actually held the handheld hand mold that was invented at some point in the late 15th century to make a single piece of type. Yeah. And today, you know, you go to the Gutenberg Museum in Mainz and they will demonstrate that. And I don't believe that Gutenberg invented that at that moment, but nobody knows. Nobody knows better than I. We all have arguments about it, you know. But still, yeah, in order to make the whole thing work, the first thing is you had to make the type and you had to have the metal correct. The metal had to be sufficiently hard to harden quickly, but still come out. And then, you know, it had to be able to absorb the ink. Gutenberg invented ink with an oil base, which hadn't existed before. You know, so all of these pieces had to come together. It's astounding that they made such an incredibly beautiful book.
Yes, yeah.
You know.
So would it be fair to say, you know, and this is my reading of the book, which turned into a real page-turner for me, I have to say, but would it be fair to say that the real romance in the book, the thing that drives it, isn't so much the characters in their development who are portrayed, I'd say, you know, as wonderfully complex individuals of different ranks contributing to the project in their own ways at various turns, but the project itself seems to be the real protagonist in the book, or the protagonist, you could say, is the hot metal type that seems to have a kind of mind and destiny of its own. It just pulls everybody else along with it.
I think that's very true. I mean, to me, that was the exciting part, was it's a story of a human drive and ambition to achieve something that had never been achieved, you know, to create something that didn't exist and to make it work. And in some ways, you know, you could say it's a business book. It's a story about invention and creation. And to me, that always was the core. And I always felt that it was very exciting. You know, it's exciting to come up against all of these twists and turns and obstacles and failures, you know, and it's sort of that, you know, if at first you don't succeed, try again. It's just that they were fighting against matter and against material to make it work. And I found that very, very interesting. I think the reading public, if they're interested in the material, they find it interesting. I think there are a lot of other people who like to have an actual romance in there. So there is an actual romance in there as well. But you actually hit it right on, Thomas. I mean, for me, that was the exciting point, was this drive to achieve this thing. And you had to be absolutely pig-headed to stick with it. It took so long. It took good 10, 15 years of repeated failure and lots of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars equivalent to get the thing to work.
At a time, I have to say, being a medievalist, when the notion of progress really hadn't been invented yet.
Well, I know. I think the question of the idea of progress is an interesting one. And I've discussed this with some of the people who are really also medievalists in this period. And I think it's really important to remember or to think that they had, I think, no notion, they could have no notion of what their invention was going to reap.
Yes.
You know, and I don't think they had a teleological view of some place that they were trying to go. And in fact, they were deeply religious and probably would have been horrified to realize that the invention would undermine the Catholic Church. I do think that Gutenberg had a goal. He was such an interesting character. He's a much more interesting character than we think, because he wasn't just a genius inventor. He was a serial entrepreneur. He had businesses before this one. He made these crazy pilgrim mirrors. He invented, you know, mass production of metal things. And then after this thing ended, he went on and continued inventing and probably invented a kind of proto-linotype. You know, he was just a restless brain. And so I agree. I think you have to be really, really careful about anachronism, particularly what I would call mental anachronism. And I was really fortunate. This is one thing I share with Hilary Mantel, is that we both had Catholic childhoods. And she once said that she thought every writer of historical fiction should have a Catholic childhood, which I think she just meant that we have to have a sense of the mystical. But I certainly could not have written this book without that knowledge. And the other thing is, the worldview that they had was so radically different from our own. I had a great time writing this book, because I really got to try to imagine what it was like for a person of that time to be setting a page from the Book of Daniel on a certain day, because all of those things had such incredible meaning for them, which are lost to us today, you know. But you just have to try to imagine yourself into their frame of reference, and it's really different. It's pre-industrial.
Yeah. So as an historical novelist, you almost necessarily have to be an historian of what the French call, you know, mentalité, mentalities, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah, and I think being a journalist, it helps, you know, because we're a bit ventriloquist. The whole idea is that you go and you listen to your sources. People speak in many different registers and from many different points of view.
Yeah, Robert Darnton said fairly much the same thing to me, who started out in life as a journalist. Betty Eisenstein talked to us a while back about the kind of fear and shock that printing caused people who first saw printed documents. And you mentioned this briefly when she was on the show talking about her book, Divine Art, Infernal Machine. And interestingly, she described this phenomenon exactly as you portray it, that, you know, that this sense of dread would come over a person gradually who was used to looking at written script, a sense of the uncanny at the regularity of the letter forms. And it's something that have to take place over a little bit of time. It's something, you know, wouldn't happen immediately. And she mentioned, by the way, also Johann Fust as an example here, being run out of Paris as a necromancer when he first tries to sell some of the finished Bibles there, although he is trying to pass them off as manuscripts when he's selling them, according to her.
Well, it's an interesting anecdote to illustrate that point. I think I've also read that it was really fundamentally an economic dispute, because he was trying to undercut them price-wise. He had dropped the price of his Bible to such an extent. But it is very much the case, but again, very hard to grasp in the documentary evidence, that there was this emotional recoil initially at seeing this print. And I think it comes back to what we were talking about, anachronism and mental anachronism. And we have to try to imagine what it was like to live in a pre-industrial age where everything that happened was determined by God. And therefore, if something occurred that was completely uncanny, it had to only have two sources. It was either godly or it came from the devil. In any case, the fact that you could produce this number of books in this regularity was magic. it had to be magic. You know, it came out of nowhere. So it was very confounding, I think. And we all know, you know, when people are confounded, often they're fearful. And I guess it's important to try to imagine. It's very hard for us to imagine a world in which things weren't made by machines. But for them, it must have been very destabilizing. Very quickly, it changed. You know, very quickly, the Catholic Church said, this is wonderful, and they called it a holy art, and they understood that it would be a tremendous way to spread the word of God. Unfortunately, not much after that, they also realized that it was a great way for people to start thinking for themselves. And by the time of our story, the Archbishop of Mainz, who the later one, has instituted censorship. And that continued until Martin Luther. So, you know, the reactions to the printing press through that whole period were very much in flux.
So the book is, of course, a page-turner. And what makes it a page-turner in part is the fact that there are really formidable obstacles to the success of this project all along the way, not the least of which are the individuals themselves. Gutenberg himself, in some ways, is his own worst enemy, isn't he?
Yeah. That's the fun part, I think, is trying to imagine a story that is dramatic. And I think there was so much riding on it financially and emotionally for both Fust and Gutenberg, and eventually for Peter too, that, you know, it had to have been kind of a high intensity endeavor. But the thing that was challenging was to try to understand how the world outside of their workshop might have reacted to this. And that's really where it didn't do any original research, but, you know, I had to imagine how the Catholic authorities of the day would have reacted to this situation. It was quite clear that these events that I describe in the novel, when the novel opens, the city of Mainz is under a ban of excommunication from the archbishop, who was the second most important man in the Holy Roman Empire, a very powerful man. You know, there was this ever-present sense of pressure from on high. And it was a time of tremendous social upheaval. As a medievalist, you know full well, you know, there was this thirst for knowledge. The universities had all opened in the last 100 years, and people in the middle classes were beginning to rise. And there was a lot of strife in the free cities in Germany, in particular in the Holy Roman Empire. You know, they had very established and successful middle classes and artisans classes and the merchants and all of the people in the guilds, and they had self-determination. So there was just this huge political conflict always boiling. And into this come Gutenberg and Fust, and Gutenberg himself came from this patrician class, from the upper classes, and Fust was a merchant who came from the guild. So I imagined quite a lot of the conflict would have to do with their various social standings. And then the whole issue for me was, how would the archbishop have reacted? Would he have tried to shut them down? Would he have tried to claim probably he would have just tried to co-opt the technology for his own ends. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of it is me just trying to imagine my way through this thicket. And it was quite clear that they had to have kept it secret to some degree.
Yeah, secrecy is a big part of the book, isn't it?
Well, they had no intellectual property rights, as you know. And in fact, in all of the historical research, the one name of this guy, Waldfogel, keeps cropping up, who was a Bohemian goldsmith who apparently was working on this invention at roughly the same time down in Avignon. So, you know, in the book, I have them hear about him and start getting very nervous, you know. So industrial espionage, and, you know, you want to get there first. And as I'm sure Ms. Eisenstein said, it was in the air du temps. If it hadn't been Gutenberg, it would have been someone else.
Yeah, there is another historical event that happens exactly at this time, and one of the defining events in Western history and Eastern history, too, I suppose. It's actually what separates or what gives us our notion of East and West, according to our historian here, Nancy Bazea, and that is the fall of Constantinople.
I found it astounding. You know, I hadn't pieced any of those things together either, but it allowed me to bring an urgency to getting the project completed. Which I think probably might well have been the case because, as you know, this was the shock to the Christian world, bar none. Mm-hmm. Someone wrote to me and said, oh, you know, they knew all about the Turks. The Turks had been moving westward for a while. That is true. But, you know, I think we forget that they didn't have communications like we have today, you know, and it took weeks for news to get to Rome. And so even if, you know, the high people in the church knew what was going on, I doubt very much that in a small town like Mainz, you know, in the day-to-day life of the guild people, that it was much on their minds. But when it happened, it was devastating. And so all of the rest of the time, the church authorities are just scrambling around trying to round up troops for a crusade. And, you know, it became a very hot period. And it also, from a trade perspective, was devastating. And to Fust's trade in particular, because he traded in a lot of goods that came out of Italy and out across the Mittelmeer, I was going to say the Mediterranean. So, you know, I had a wonderful time. Actually, the most fun I had in the whole thing was researching the Frankfurt Fair in the late Middle Ages. The amount of goods that transited across the continent and ended up on all these different trading axes in Frankfurt was remarkable. And this was globalization well before the word.
And it makes another link with our own time, of course, in the book, after 9/11, and especially in light of what Obama had to say last week about the Crusades.
Well, and I did feel, you know, when I was writing the section about the fall of Constantinople, it was not that long after 9/11. And the book has been a long time in the gestation and writing, and I was very aware of that. I wanted it to have a little bit of resonance, you know, that the civilizational clash, these echoes through history are eerie.
Yeah, and I think it's Benedetto Croce who makes the case that all history is contemporary history, that history is always about contemporary fears and anxieties.
I think that's the only, I won't say the only reason to do historical fiction, but it's an important reason, you know, is you want to look at the past in order to better cast a light on the present. And I really wanted to use, but I never got around to it, a quote from Gadamer, the great German philosopher, that says, you know, the voices of the past are only truly audible when we look at them through the prism of the present.
Yeah, interesting. So yeah. Speaking of the relation of the past and the present, as a printer, how much of what you learned about printing can be traced directly back to Gutenberg's original media lab here?
Everything. Nothing has changed. No, it's so amazing. Well, I started learning in the 70s. So at that time, it was the very end of the hot type era, and what we called cold type offset printing had come in the 50s and 60s. So it was tailing off completely. But fundamentally, the technology had not changed in 500 years, in the sense that you still used a piece of cast metal type, and you still put ink on it, and you still put it in a press. You might have a motor on the press, you might cast the type mechanically, but fundamentally it was exactly the same technology. And what's happened, what's so interesting though, what's happened, so for, I would say for about 20, 30 years, it really disappeared. But young people today, I've just written an article about this for The Economist, about this revival of letterpress printing, because what happened is someone invented a technique for making a polymer plastic plate from a digital file that could be used on a letterpress. So you have an entire new generation of designers who really love the feel of deeply impressed printing. So there's been this tremendous return, and they also, you know, are tired of sitting in front of the screen and punching buttons all day. You know, it's much more satisfying to make things with your hands. So there's quite a revival going on. You would be amazed. I mean, there are book art centers now all over the country. Certainly in the U.S. it's huge, and in Britain too, with just new one just opened in London last year. So young people, you know, they use digital and letterpress together. It's astounding.
Yeah, interesting. And of course, we have 3D printing now.
Yeah. Well, here in London recently, they just cast type using 3D printing.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
It's really gone around. No, it's gone full circle. And it's great. It's that whole question about what technology we use for making or for reading. I really object to this idea that it's an either or, you know, and you throw out the old and you embrace the new and you never look back. Because, for example, there's a great graphic designer in Germany who started as a letterpress printer, became very famous as a graphic designer, and he now just had an electronic type cut in wood at the Hamilton Wood Type Factory in Wisconsin. So the digital and the analog inform each other reciprocally. It's interesting.
Has hand press printing with metal type become a kind of historical activity itself, you know, like historical reenactments, or is there actually a tangible real need for it yet?
I think there's a need, and there's certainly a niche for it. You know, there have always been, for the last 200 years, there have been so-called fine printers who do fine letterpress editions, going back to William Morris and going up to the Aryan Press in San Francisco. So you've always had people who serve a clientele of very wealthy people making very fine letterpress editions. And the Folio Society just brought out a letterpress edition of Shakespeare, for example. But on the other side of that, you have artists making artist books who are using letterpress as one of many technologies and techniques, along with screen printing, offset, digital. It's just one more tool in the toolbox for creating objects. So I think both of those will continue. And I recently did a panel with Eric Spiekerman, this graphic designer, for a bunch of technologists about print and the future of print. And I actually believe very strongly that it will continue to be a really important part of the mix. Because what's happened in the book industry is that the ebooks have cannibalized paperbacks, but not the hardback. The hardbacks, apparently, the booksellers tell me they've noticed they've been getting more and more handsome and more and more object-like.
They're very large, I notice. You know, working with academic books, when I see a shelf full of, you know, recent fiction, you know, when you go to Barnes & Noble or whatever, they, you know, they're very hefty, sizable, physical things.
And I think the thinking is, and I think it makes a lot of sense, that if you're going to make a print book, make a real print book. You know, don't make something that's quasi-disposable. Make something that really has a lot of thought and care and that you want to keep on your shelf. And the only things that you want to keep on your shelf are things that you want to preserve. Therefore, the container should be a quality container. And, you know, my book, just to blow the horn of the designers at Harper, I mean, they did an extraordinary job.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. They did. You've got a decal edge, I notice, on the
Harper. A decal edge and a die cut.
Yes.
And a die cut.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful. And the typeface is wonderful also. And I see you use various typefaces.
Exactly. Yeah, no, and it was the designers themselves, you know, and I think what they understood is that, you know, it's a book about the first printed book, the most beautiful and valuable book in the world, you know, so the book itself should be a beautiful object. Yeah. And they were very excited, the designers, the cover designer and the interior designer. We collaborated a lot, you know, and that was very satisfying to me.
Yeah, and you have the wonderful image of Mainz on the cover. Is that from the Nuremberg Chronicle?
No, it's not. It was not in the Nuremberg. It was never printed. It's just a woodcut. Mm-hmm. It's from 1565. It was not published in any book. It was simply a woodcut. In the Nuremberg Chronicle, they have another cut of Mainz, but, you know, they used the same woodcuts interchangeably for many different cities. So,
Every city looks like Nuremberg.
Now, I was very lucky because the archive, the Mainz archive and the Frankfurt Historical Museum, and they were very generous with their imagery. And as I said before, you know, the imagery helps you so much to enter into the world. And I think for me, it was the emotional connection I felt with Gothic architecture and with this period that, you know, allowed me to kind of enter into it. And I put a lot of them on my website. So,
it's really an important image for me as I'm reading the book, because so much of the book is about the landscape and the coming to Mainz on the river. And then it is an urban tale also.
It is. It's you know, situated in a pretty small town, you know, and you spend most of your time in that town. So it is important. But if anybody wants to see any other fabulous images of Frankfurt during the fair and all of these historical figures who really existed, like Piccolomini or Nicholas Cusanus, I have reproduced paintings and artworks at gutenbergsapprentice.com. And I really had a lot of fun because I wanted everybody, the readers, to see the same things that I saw when I was writing.
Yeah, it's a great website. You've got a lot in there.
Labor of love.
So you've been a writer a long time and thought of yourself as a writer since you were 10 years old, as you said. But now you're not just a writer, you're a novelist and a published novelist. And I imagine that must be a very satisfying thing.
Incredible. It's, really, it would not be an overstatement to say it is my dream come true, you know? And I think it's really a testament. I've thought a lot about why it happened because, you know, it's my first novel and you hope to get published. You certainly are thrilled to get published and to be published by a big house like Harper and have them put so much love and care and print 25,000 copies of your book. It's a miracle. And I really think it's because of the passion that I have for the subject. You know, it all has seemed very organic and fed into itself. You know, if you love something enough, somehow it seems to come together if you stick to it long enough. And I always say that I had a 7-year apprenticeship on this book, and that was the exact length of the apprenticeship in a medieval guild. And you just have to stick with it, really.
Yeah. Interesting. And, you know, as a project, I expect it was very much like Gutenberg's project. You must have seemed harebrained at certain times.
You never imagine that you're going to succeed. And, you know, being a journalist is a good training in the sense that you get very thick-skinned about people editing your work, and you have a good work ethic about writing. But fiction is more difficult in that you pour more of your whole self into it, I would say, emotionally. And then, you know, the rejection is constant and unrelenting. And you have to, at a certain point, believe in it only for yourself. I think if you try to write something to sell it, it will never succeed. You just have to, as Gutenberg did, I suppose, you know, put your head down and just pigheadedly keep going.
Yeah. So do you have anything that you're working on now? Are you planning to write another novel?
I am.
You are.
I'm writing an American novel, which is about time, I think. I've been in Europe a long time, but I'm going to write the story of my Scottish ancestors who emigrated to the great Pacific Northwest and the Rocky Mountains and in the middle of the Indian Wars. So it's a whole different continent, a whole different set of problems. But the thing that it has in common, I think, is that I'm really, really passionate about the subject because it's my whole family history. And I have a lot of material already and I kind of can't wait to sink my teeth into it.
So it's another historical novel.
It will be. Yeah, I think I don't know if I'll always write them, but I find, as they say, truth is stranger than fiction, and there's so much richness, and it suits me because I am someone who likes to really delve in and learn as soak up as much as possible. So for the moment, I'm not spinning them out of my imagination, but you know, the people are who they are is where you get to do the imaginative work.
And one question I always ask my guests on the show, since the show's about libraries to some extent, can you talk about the libraries you worked in to do your research? I mean, do you have any anecdotes or memorable experiences or favorite libraries?
Well, I am a very happy member of the London Library, which is a historic London library frequented mostly by writers, and we all find a home in the Carrolls there. It's downtown on St. James's Square.
And is it a subscription library? Or
it's a membership-only library. And it's the last research library in the UK that has OpenStax. And it is so idiosyncratically arranged. You know, there are sections on cheese and chalk. And, you know, you would love it. Anytime, please come to London, I'll give you a tour. But most of my research I did in Germany in the state library there, in the Staatsbibliothek in Berlin. And they, of course, have a massive collection. And then I also spent a very memorable, very hot week in Mainz, in the university library there, literally sweating, you know, in the attics. But again, they had a very open access policy. And you could just go in and sit there and pull the books off the shelves, which I always find to be so stimulating, you know, but you usually want the book next to the one you think you want.
So I'd like to thank you, Alex, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today to talk about your book, Gutenberg's Apprentice, published by HarperCollins in 2014.
Thank you, Thomas. It's been a great pleasure, and it's really a particular pleasure to talk to a vaster audience.